Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present BBC TV investigative reporter Greg Pallast, who assesses the performance of President Obama in dealing with the current economic crisis. Filmmaker and author Danny Schechter, who examines the corporate media's failure to investigate Wall Street's reckless gambling schemes, which triggered the economic meltdown. And Danny Vroe of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who discusses the impacts of soil erosion on New Orleans and Gulf Coast safety in hurricane season and the importance of wetlands to the Louisiana fisheries industry. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After a month-long offensive on the eastern edge of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC, by government and Rwandan troops, Hutu rebels are fighting back. The rebels, known as the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, who harbor people linked to the atrocities committed in the Rwanda genocide in 1994, have taken back several military bases from Congolese troops. According to the Christian Science Monitor, 35,000 villagers were forced to flee in early March due to renewed fighting. The rebels have also retaliated against Western aid groups operating in the eastern Congo. The joint DRC-Rwanda force has captured 450 rebel fighters and returned over 5,000 people to Rwanda. The strong rebel advance has revived fears of new human rights abuses. Facing a wave of factory closings by U.S.-based manufacturers, Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega has called for an American bailout. Ortega made the plea for more aid at a meeting of Central American presidents debating the implementation of the Central American Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA. According to the Miami Herald, Nicaragua faces up to 50,000 additional lost textile jobs in the coming year. U.S. textile giant Cone Denim, who recently invested $100 million in Nicaragua, has decided to suspend its operations there. Sandinista President Ortega says the Obama administration has an obligation to invest more money in Central American countries. Despite the crisis, no Latin American country has sought aid from the International Monetary Fund. There is still lingering anger at the IMF over its imposition of neoliberal economic policies during the 1980s and 90s. In recent months, the IMF has doled out $40 billion in aid to Eastern European nations. Latin American countries have also been hard hit by a fall-off in remittances from relatives in the United States. Latino immigrants, hard hit by the housing crash, now have less money to send to their families and are at higher risk of being deported to their native land. In a sign of the failing U.S. economy, emergency shelters in the California state capital are turning away over 200 women and children a night. A tent city in Sacramento made national news after a crew from the Oprah Winfrey Show visited the site. President Obama observed it was unacceptable for women and children to live on the street in the United States. Since then, California authorities declared that the illegal settlement will be closed and shelter would be found for the residents. Michael Stoops of the National Coalition for the Homeless told the New York Times, "These are able-bodied folks that did day labor at minimum wage or better who were previously able to house themselves." Last year, homeless people in Fresno, California, won a $2.4 million lawsuit against the city and the State Department of Transportation in compensation for belongings that were seized in various police raids. Kelly Dockendorf of nearby St. John's Shelter observed, "What's different this time around is that many more of those who are homeless are educated and working, but not making enough money to pay the bills." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
After the Obama administration forced the resignation of General Motors CEO Rick Wagoner in return for more federal bailout money being funneled to the troubled carmaker, attention has turned to the question why Wall Street CEOs receiving billions in taxpayer funds aren't similarly pressured to resign. Democratic Senator Carl Levin of Michigan noted a double standard giving banks better treatment than the auto industry. Many workers say the government hasn't dictated such harsh terms to insurance giant AIG or the banks, which in large part caused the financial crisis. President Obama said his administration will offer GM adequate working capital during the next 60 days to produce an acceptable reorganization plan. Meanwhile, the White House gave Chrysler 30 days to negotiate a merger with Italian automaker Fiat. Tennessee Republican Senator Bob Corker criticized the government's firing of GM's Wagoner, saying that this is a major power grab by the White House and should send a chill through all Americans who believe in free enterprise. However, Corker and other Senate Republicans had a completely different attitude toward the United Auto Workers when the legislators demanded the union make deep concessions in return for the first allocation of federal bailout money to the auto industry last December. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with BBC TV investigative reporter Greg Palast, who assesses the performance of President Obama in dealing with the current economic crisis.
Look, compared to the last guy, Obama is Mount Rushmore material. Other than that, he is definitely failing to stop the economy from flying straight off the financial cliff. You know, we're blaming Timmy Geithner, his Secretary of Treasury, but when I objected at that horrendous appointments of Geithner and Summers, Larry Summers, as his economic team, I was told, hey, listen, Obama's the president and he'll control these guys. So, you know, there's no sense hiding behind them now. But I will say this. He maybe is doing as much as Congress will allow him to do. He is, after all, president, not emperor. And even with his teeny-weeny stimulus bill, and it is teeny-weeny, $700 billion in a $50 trillion economy ain't much. You know, I mean, if you were told someone to step on the gas in the car, you wouldn't say, hey, step on it. Raise your speed from 22 to 24 miles an hour. I mean, it's absurd. The stimulus bill is woefully inadequate. And yet even that caused, you know, tremendous hair pulling among the elite and that disturbed group of individuals called moderate Republicans.
We've read the news that Obama has effectively fired General Motors Chair Rick Wagoner. But many of the heads of the failed banks and financial institutions that caused all these enormous problems, the cataclysm around the world economically, they still have their very cushy and high-paying jobs. Guys like Bank of America Chair Kenneth Lewis that you've written about.
Yeah, that's really no joke. Okay, Wagoner does certainly deserve to lose his job. I mean, basically, the board of directors deserve to lose their job for not dumping him already. You know, a guy let lose $27 billion in a year. But heck, Lewis's Merrill Lynch unit lost $15 billion in 3 months. And then he said he didn't even know about it. And he's got his job. And worse, he's got his job on our payroll. I was sickened to watch the meeting of Obama and the bankers. And the discussion was reported as if it were some type of equal discussion, you know, give and take, back and forth, a meeting of minds. We, the people of the United States, effectively now own Bank of America. So what he needs to do is tell Lewis, okay, you work for us now, buddy. This is what Roosevelt did. He closed the banks down. He called it a bank holiday, Franklin Roosevelt. But it wasn't a holiday. It was a bank closure. And he said, when you reopen, we will guarantee your deposits, we'll guarantee your capital, but here's the terms. And Obama does not seem to be able to, nor does Geithner, seem to be able to tell the banks what to do. They keep begging the banks. As long as you beg the banks, as long as, you know, if you keep telling the mafia, if you guys would only be nicer, we'll give you some more money. You know what? We know it doesn't work. It hasn't worked.
Greg, we don't have a lot of time left, but I wanted to ask you about this. There was a lot of attention, a lot of focus on the obscene AIG bonuses. But it really maybe, in a way, served as a distraction to some of the bigger issues that we ought to be considering as a country. But what are some of the other major issues you think that the media really should be focusing in on that they're not?
Well, I think one of the things is where the AIG big money went, $150 billion, $200 billion were you're sending there. And basically, AIG is simply a money laundering operation, literally. We give it to AIG, they give it to Goldman Sachs, $15 billion, to Deutsche Bank, to Union Bank of Switzerland, people that we wouldn't give money to directly, or we do with strings attached. So Goldman Sachs says, we will not accept more money from the Treasury because it comes with strings attached. Rather, they launder it through AIG where there's no strings attached. Strings attached is very important. These investment banks have become gambling operations, and we've got to stop the gambling, period. When they talk about re-regulating, we have to end some of these markets.
And just lastly, Greg, I wanted to ask you this. You know, aside from the criticism that you're making now of the Obama administration, on the right, there's a lot of charges of socialism and dictatorship, and there's all of a sudden a newfound concern about the tenets of the U.S. Constitution on the right. How would you assess this newfound religion there on the right?
Well, you know, we had the Guantanamo right is now concerned that Obama is stretching his presidential powers. But, of course, they called Roosevelt a dictator, too. You know, I think that it's not that he's a dictator. They just don't like who he's dictating to. The fact that he's even telling General Motors, you know, you can't be blowing away our money and taking down the entire economy of the state of Michigan. You know, that will not stand. They prefer dictating in another way, you know, like dictating and telling us which wars we're going to get into on false information. So, you know, so they just don't like who's dictated to, and they certainly don't like who's doing the dictating. Obama, again, is no FDR, but one thing he isn't is George Bush. He is actually addressing the issue. Let's not forget that just before he left office, Bush refused to take any action to save the economy, any action to stimulate the economy. He said, unless we also pass CAFTA. You know, I mean, you know, the ship is going down, and he's saying, unless you paint the captain's quarters, he's not going to, you know, the captain's not going to do anything about the ship going down.
That was BBC TV investigative reporter and author of Armed Madhouse, Greg Pallast. Read his articles and see a trailer of his new video, Pallast Investigates, online at gregpallast.com. As widespread anger still lingers about the $165 million in bonuses paid to employees at the failed insurance giant AIG, bailed out by more than $170 billion in taxpayer funds, another larger set of bonuses is being investigated. Representative Dennis Kucinich, Democrat of Ohio, chair of the Domestic Policy Subcommittee of the House Oversight and Government Reform Panel, has opened an inquiry into about $3.6 billion in bonuses paid to Merrill Lynch employees, 22 times larger than bonuses paid by AIG. The bonuses were set in December, after the government allocated $10 billion in bailout funds to help save the firm from collapse by brokering its sale to Bank of America. Americans generally were taken by surprise when the economic collapse struck last fall. Much of the blame, critics say, can be placed on Congress, which deregulated the industry, then turned a blind eye to reckless casino games played with subprime mortgages and credit default swaps. But the corporate media also played a pivotal role with its decision not to aggressively report on these dodgy financial practices, which triggered the current economic meltdown. The business media's cozy relationship with Wall Street movers and shakers was exposed when The Daily Show's Jon Stewart skewered the CNBC business cable channel. Stewart bluntly criticized CNBC's Jim Cramer, Rick Santelli, and others for their uncritical reporting of Wall Street's dangerous scams and fawning coverage of corporate billionaires. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with filmmaker and author Danny Schechter, who examines the corporate media's failure to investigate Wall Street's irresponsible schemes, which brought on the economic collapse.
Well, you know, we've all heard about embedded journalism in connection with the war in Iraq, but we don't think of it as a concept here at home, where, you know, journalists are basically embedded in a culture. They're embedded in a mainstream media culture on the one hand, where, you know, basically the decisions are made in command modules by top editors about what gets covered and what doesn't, how it gets covered and the rest. But in terms of business journalism, many journalists are culturally embedded in the market system, in the in covering a business from a uncritical perspective, basically, reporting on it in terms of its excitement, economic growth, CEOs who are gods in our society, basically masters of the universe, as they've been described. And what we're missing is the kind of critical and analytical journalism and investigative journalism that, you know, we really needed here. So when this credit crisis or housing bubble started, you know, in 2002, what happened was, you know, that there was almost no coverage. At the same time that the bubble started, you know, everybody I knew in the media was talking about the worth of their apartments, how much money they could get reselling it, you know, what their net worth and value were. And we all got sort of sucked into this to some degree, but we weren't paying attention, most of us anyway, to predatory lending, to the practices that led to the transfer of an enormous amount of wealth from the poorest people in America to the richest institutions. And that's what happened with subprime lending, with all kinds of mortgage scams that the FBI is now investigating and is acknowledging that there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud. In the same period, something like $3 billion was being spent by dodgy lenders and credit card companies in media advertising and on newspapers, on TV, and, you know, and on the internet. The consequence is, you know, when there's a lot of money coming in from an industry, there's a tendency, you know, not to cover that industry in a critical way.
Danny, you've written about how our media system profited during the real estate boom with print advertisements and many other ways. They made billions of dollars. Did they not have a conflict of interest in blowing the whistle on this stuff?
Well, I think there was a conflict of interest, but it really wasn't perceived that way. In other words, they weren't making money necessarily personally on predatory lending or subprime lending, et cetera, and so forth. But what was happening was that by not looking at it, by not blowing the whistle on it, most of us were kind of amazed and surprised that all of a sudden one day the economy collapsed, you know, and collapsed all around us. And I think this is a failure of journalism, a major failure. I'm making a film now based on my book, Plunder. And, you know, I interviewed a journalist at Columbia Journalism Review, formerly with the Wall Street Journal. You know, he's saying this too. He's saying that, you know, the media was asleep at the switch just the way the regulators were. And, you know, playing catch-up ball now, but still not looking at what I think is a core part of this whole problem, which is crime. You know, it's not just Bernie Madoff. Ponzi schemes, you know, are massive and pervasive. Corporate crime, you know, is involved in lots of stuff, like the misrepresentation of the value of mortgage-backed securities, you know, asset-backed securities, selling them all over the world when they had no value. And so what started, you know, as a small-time hustle turned into a massive level of fraud, which has still not been investigated. I have a piece on MediaChannel.org right now about the Pecora Commission. I don't know how many of you listeners know about this, but in 1932, a commission was formed under the auspices of a guy named Ferdinand Pecora, investigating the crash of 29, the Big Bang, the Big Depression. And they found, you know, massive, what they call corporate larceny. You know, bankers who didn't want to know, people who were speculating, margin, you know, making investments with money they didn't have and all the rest of it. And the net effect of it was a depression that threw millions of out of work and devastated a generation. And we're in a similar situation today. I mean, there is no way of saying that this thing is solved.
I think we all watch with great satisfaction when The Daily Show's Jon Stewart skewered CNBC's Rick Santelli and Jim Cramer. And, you know, it's one of those rare moments in major corporate media where you actually had the truth being spoken unvarnished, at least for a few minutes there in that part of The Daily Show special on this. And I wonder, do you think the corporate media, viewing its failure in covering this economic crisis, has taken to reflect on itself?
Basically gloating about, you know, how smart they all are. But, you know, I think that there's a recognition that the financial journalism world has failed us, and many people in the media are now writing about that honestly and knowledgeably about it. You know, so yes, there is more coming out, but you know, ask yourself this question: why is it that we, you know, the only place you can get some truth is on a comedy show? What's going on here? Why aren't other voices heard in our media? Scott, you should be doing the Daily Show. Jon Stewart is brilliant. He's funny and all the rest of it. But sometimes it's about attitude. You know, everybody else is stupid except us. And I'm not sure how much people really learn. I have a great deal of admiration for Jon Stewart. I think he is outspoken. He's well informed. He tries to raise these questions. But it's ironic to me that all of this is taking place, you know, in comedy news, not on the real news.
That was author and filmmaker Danny Schechter, co-founder of MediaChannel.org. His latest book is titled Plunder, Investigating Our Economic Calamity and the Subprime Scandal. Read Danny's News Dissector blog online at MediaChannel.org. The area around New Orleans has lost much of the wetland acreage that helped protect the city from hurricane storm surges. Since Hurricane Katrina hit in 2005, many public agencies and private organizations have increased their efforts to plant grasses and trees at the water's edge to enable soil to gather around the roots and gradually build more protective land. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus participated in one such effort in late March, in conjunction with Common Ground Relief and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She joined a group of 25 volunteers who were ferried by airboat to a tiny reclaimed piece of land in the Big Branch Wildlife Preserve on the north shore of Lake Pontchartrain, about an hour from New Orleans. After spotting half a dozen small alligators in the canal on the trip, they spent the day planting spartina grass, salt hay, and bulrushes, often sinking into the black mud above their knees. Tuhu spoke with Danny Bro, a 20-year employee of the Fish and Wildlife Service, who coordinates volunteer efforts at Big Branch. He talked about the impacts of soil erosion on resident safety in a hurricane season, as well as the importance of wetlands to the Louisiana fisheries industry.
When Katrina came, the eye wall of Katrina passed through the city of Slidell, which the refuge encompasses some of the city of Slidell. So the eye wall passed pretty close to the whole refuge. Some of the refuge went through the eye wall. And on the east side of the refuge, we had about 16 feet of storm surge that came over. So the entire refuge was inundated with water. On that side, it was 16 feet deep. And there are several stands of pine trees that got killed because of that, entire stands of pine trees. And on the west side, over here like around Mandeville, it was 8 feet deep, and Lacombe around 8 feet deep. So even though all this was underwater, it was less than the east side. But 8 feet of water can carry a lot of damage. And over the course of the whole refuge, we had 2,500 acres of marsh that got converted to open water. In other words, it was hard, dry marsh, just like, you know, the stuff we were riding over. It's got Spartina patens and alternate flora and three square all growing in it. And the tidal action, or the, you know, it's almost like a tsunami or a gradual rise. It was really a mix of both. It caused the wave actions to knock the marsh out and rolled it up into a ball, and it would have a massive rolling of marsh grass that really got deposited on the streets and the pine trees. And so it took 2,500 acres of what was hard, dry marsh, rolled it up with the roots in the mud, and threw it into the upper areas. That, in combination with, in the entire last 50 years, we've had marsh subsidence, erosion, and have been losing a lot of the marshlands over time. Katrina just added another 50 years of the slow erosion in one full swoop event. But even before Katrina, we were planning projects to try to recover the marsh. One of those was a QIPRA project, which QIPRA, it's C-W-P-P-R-A. I believe it stands for Coastal Wetland Planning Protection Restoration Act. Part of the reason why we wanted to create this project here was because this was so deep, I say deep, 3 feet deep. If you have real shallow, like 6 inches, you don't get a whole lot of wave actions. And if you have real deep, you don't get a whole lot. I mean, like 20, 30 feet deep, you won't get a lot. But that 7 to 14 or even 3 foot, you get a lot of wave actions involved with winds like now. I could show you out in the lake, how rough it is right now. You probably have 3-foot swells or more.
Is Lake Pontchartrain man-made?
No.
No, it's a
natural made. In fact, when you look at some satellite views, you can see the natural drainages of the bayous that go through the lake. So several thousand years ago, or you know, that could have been dry, and you just had a meandering channel that went through it. What this project did by making it shallow is it's preventing the wave action from occurring in this lake. And what the wave actions did is it would slam against that bank where that marsh grass is, and every time you throw water, it's like hosing it. It just makes more mud fall off. And the more mud falls off, the more the vegetation doesn't have anything to cling to. And then with the tide rising and falling, it just carries that mud back out into the lake. So in essence, we kind of put the mud back where it was several thousand years ago, where it's been kind of slowly going into the lake.
Can you just tell me what do you think the usefulness is of a project like this that brings volunteers who, you know, who really know nothing about this, but then I get a little quick training and just continuing round of volunteers?
Well, we didn't really get any money to plant this. There's some hopes that some of it will vegetate on its own, but I have several volunteer groups that want to come help. There's Common Ground, there's Bayou Rebirth, and the parish got a grant from NOAA to come plant about 18 acres. And there's a volunteer group from Baton Rouge that's planning on coming out next week. So I'm using all that to at least put a planting in the area that's the most erodible. And that's some of these areas where there's cuts in the berms. When the tide comes in, or if a storm surge comes in, that's going to be the area that is most in danger of being lost from the water moving out. So if we can get that planted with any kind of marsh grass, that'll buffer the effect of the tide and the storm.
And you think that people coming in to do this, that's useful then?
Well, it's useful for us to protect it, and it's useful for all these volunteers because they get to see what Louisiana marshes are like. They get to bring that back home. They get that experience of knowing that they've done something good to help save the coastline, because Louisiana's marshes make up a large part of the marshes in the whole United States, and it's a huge nursery ground for all kind of fisheries. If I took you out in a boat in some of this water, you'd see fish jumping everywhere. There's crabs and shrimp and all the young nursery grounds for all the fish that people eat, catch and eat. So it helps protect that too.
That was Danny Breaux of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Contact the agency at area code 504-442-2314 or visit their website at fws.gov. Additional information on the group Common Ground Relief can be found on their website, commongroundrelief.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and Real Audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.